Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Have you ever walked through an airport, maybe a train station, and seen the same, like, three books just everywhere? You know, stacked high on every shelf.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The ones you feel like you have to read because everyone else is.
Exactly. Those are the literary blockbusters we're talking about today. We're going to sort of pop the hood on that whole phenomenon.
Look at the machinery behind it all.
Yeah. Tear apart the secret mechanics behind how certain books become, well, almost cultural inevitabilities.
And for this, we're leaning on a really fantastic guide, John Sutherland's book, Bestsellers.
Yeah.
A very short introduction. It's super insightful.
Okay, so our mission today isn't just about looking at sales figures, like millions of copies sold. That's part of it, sure.
But not the whole story.
Right. The real deep dive here is figuring out how certain books get that level of cultural saturation, you know? What's the system, the process that takes a book from manuscript to this global thing everyone's reading?
And Sutherland gives us a really crucial, maybe even a slightly, cynical starting point.
Oh, how so?
Well, he basically argues that a bestseller isn't just about selling a lot. It's a complex cultural artifact, but fundamentally, it's a manufactured product.
Manufactured, like built in a factory.
Well, maybe not a factory with smokestacks, but definitely the product of a specific industrial system. And his whole analysis kind of forces you to draw a line, a really clear one, between, say, artistic quality and commercial success. They aren't the same thing.
Okay, if we're separating art from sales figures, we need someone who can look at both sides fairly. So who is John Sutherland? Why should we trust his take on this?
That's a fair question. Sutherland is, well, he's a very highly respected literary critic, like top tier. Comes with deep expertise, especially in Victorian fiction.
Okay, sounds quite academic.
It does, right? He was the Lord Northcliffe Professor Emeritus at University College London for ages. You'd maybe expect someone like that to be a bit sniffy about popular fiction.
Look down on the stuff you find at the supermarket checkout.
Exactly. But that's what makes his perspective so, so valuable.
He
seems to just effortlessly bridge these two worlds. You know, the world of Dickens and Austen, the literary canon, and the world of pure popular culture. Like, he'll take a Danielle Steele novel or a massive blockbuster thriller and apply the exact same level of analytical rigor to it as he would to, I don't know, Middlemarch.
Wow. So he avoids that kind of literary snobbery completely.
Which is key, I think.
Yeah.
He sees that book dominating the bestseller lists, not just as something popular, but as a valid cultural artifact, something that tells us something important, maybe even profound, about what our society actually values or is thinking about right now.
He's using it like a cultural thermometer, maybe, not a report card for literature.
That's a great way to put it. He's got the insider knowledge of literary history, but also this really keen eye on the current market. It gives him this perfect vantage point to explain the mechanics of the whole machine.
Okay, let's dig into that machine then. What's his core argument? If becoming a modern blockbuster isn't just down to luck or even just being brilliantly written, what is it about?
Fundamentally, he argues it's this powerful, extremely well-oiled machine, and it's driven really by one key metric.
Which is?
Sales velocity.
Velocity. Okay, so speed. Like how fast it sells, not just how many.
Precisely. Think about it. A book might sell a million copies over, say, 20 years. That's a solid success, right? A good backlist title.
Sure, publishers would be happy with that.
But compare that to a book that sells a million copies in its first month or even its first week. That's not just success. That's a phenomenon.
Right. That's the thing everyone's suddenly talking about.
Exactly. And it's that speed, that incredible velocity right at the start that generates all the media buzz, the news stories, the interviews, the social media chatter.
Which then pushes it onto the bestseller lists.
Which then acts as free advertising, creating this sense of urgency. Oh, I need to read that. Which drives more velocity. It's a self-perpetuating cycle.
Huh. So it's the difference between, like, a steady drip and a tidal wave. People feel they have to be part of that wave, that cultural moment. It feels kind of counterintuitive, though, focusing on speed over, you know, substance.
It does, but Sutherland argues it's absolutely critical to the economics of modern publishing. If a book sells slowly, it's just another product on the shelf. If it sells fast, it becomes news. It becomes an event.
And this isn't entirely new?
No, not entirely. He traces the roots back. I mean, the idea of a bestseller needed certain things to exist first, like Gutenberg's printing press making mass production possible.
So lots of people could read the same thing at the same time.
Exactly, creating the potential for a shared reading moment. And then the rise of the novel itself in the 18th century. But he also points to how authors started becoming brands.
Brands like Nike or Coca-Cola.
Sort of, yeah. He identifies Sir Walter Scott back in the early 19th century as arguably the first modern celebrity brand author.
Really? Walter Scott?
Yeah. Apparently, his name alone, slapped on the cover, guaranteed huge sales for whatever he wrote next. He basically set the model for the mega authors we see today. You know, your Grishams, your Kings, your Rowlings.
Okay, so Scott establishes the author as brand idea. But the machine feels much bigger, more intense now. What ramped it up in the last, say, 50 years?
That's when the high-stakes financial model really took hold. It became much more calculated.
How so?
Well, the author isn't just expected to write the book anymore. Now they're often expected to be a brand ambassador too, right? Doing tours, social media, the whole thing.
And the agent.
The literary agent becomes this absolutely central power broker. Their job is to leverage the author's brand or potential brand to secure these massive advances from publishers, sometimes millions up front.
Millions. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So the publisher, Sutherland sees them less as like guardians of culture and more as venture capitalists. That's his term. They put down this huge initial bet, the advance, and then they have to spend millions more on marketing, on promotion, just to make sure that initial bet pays off.
So they're protecting their investment.
Massively. He uses this really striking analogy. The publisher operates less like a library curator, carefully selecting books.
And more like,
More like a casino.
yeah.
Seriously. They're placing these enormous wagers on a very small number of titles, the potential jackpots.
The blockbusters.
Right. And the expectation is that those few massive hits will generate so much profit that they'll cover all the costs, all the advances, all the losses from the hundreds, maybe thousands of other books on their list that don't earn back their money.
Okay, so it's like a portfolio strategy in finance. You need a few huge winners to carry all the modest ones and the outright failures.
Exactly. And the engine that often stabilizes that whole portfolio, the reliable earner,
The
that's usually genre fiction.
thrillers, romance, mysteries,
Yeah.
that kind of thing.
Precisely. Sutherland calls this the principle of predictable pleasure. Authors like James Patterson, Nora Roberts, Lee Child, they provide a consistent, reliable, satisfying reading experience.
Readers know what they're getting and they like it.
And they come back for more, book after book. That predictability provides the stable financial backbone for the whole publishing house, allowing them to take risks elsewhere.
And this calculation, this sort of hard-nosed business approach, it even extends down to the physical book itself, right? The format.
Oh, absolutely. His breakdown of the economics of format is, well, it's pretty brilliant, actually, the whole hardback versus paperback strategy.
Explain that, the hard versus soft bestsellers.
Okay, so the expensive hardback comes out first, right? High price point. It targets two main groups, libraries, and the author's most dedicated diehard fans, the ones who have to have it on day one.
Okay, so that creates the initial buzz, gets it onto the bestseller lists, maybe.
Exactly. It generates that crucial initial velocity and
Yeah.
gives the book a sense of prestige. Then maybe 6 months, maybe a year later, boom.
The paperback arrives.
The mass market paperback, much lower price point, designed to just flood the market and capture everyone else, the casual readers, the airport buyers.
Wait a minute. So are they basically penalizing the most loyal fans, making them pay a premium for the hardback just because they're eager?
From a purely economic perspective, yeah, pretty much.
Right.
Sutherland points out that this staggered release is a classic example of price discrimination.
Like airlines charging different prices for the same flight.
Exactly like that. You maximize your total revenue by charging different prices to different segments of the market based on their willingness to pay or their desire for immediacy. First, you get the high-value customers who want it NOW. Then you sweep up the volume later with the lower price.
That's kind of cynical, but makes sense from a business view. Treats the book just like any other consumer good, like a new phone or something.
It really does. It demystifies it a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, beyond this internal publishing machinery, there are also the external forces, the gatekeepers.
Right, like literary prizes. A Booker or a Nobel can definitely push a more literary novel onto the bestseller lists.
For sure, those prestigious awards carry weight. But Sutherland identifies an even bigger shift in power, a more potent external force in recent decades.
Let me guess.
Oprah.
Bingo, the Oprah effect. You really can't overstate its impact.
Her book club was phenomenal.
It demonstrated, maybe for the first time on that scale, that a single, trusted, authentic recommendation could just completely bypass millions in traditional marketing spend.
And instantly create a million seller, literally overnight sometimes.
Yeah. It was kind of the birth of modern influencer marketing, wasn't it? It proved that audience trust in a specific person could be way more powerful than a huge advertising budget. Power shifted away from traditional critics and marketing departments directly to these trusted recommenders.
Okay, so if we pull all this together, the velocity, the casino publishing model, the price strategy, the influencers, what are the big takeaways for us just trying to understand the books we see everywhere? Well, I think we can pull out maybe three key themes that Sutherland really emphasizes, things that help make sense of it all. First, and this is crucial, bestsellers nearly always act as a reflection of the zeitgeist.
Meaning they tap into the current mood.
Exactly. They succeed, often wildly, because they connect directly with the collective anxieties or the hopes, or maybe the curiosities of that specific moment in time. Think about the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah. That was massive.
Massive. And sure, it was a pacey thriller, but its phenomenal success wasn't just about the plot. It exploded. Because it tapped right into that post-9/11 cultural vibe, you know?
Yeah.
That the distrust of big institutions, that fascination with conspiracy theories, hidden histories.
It gave a concrete story to a kind of vague ambient feeling people had.
Perfectly put. That's the first point. Second, we kind of touched on this already, is the importance of predictable pleasure.
The genre fiction engine.
Right. The publishing industry needs those reliable blockbusters from the established genre writers. They provide the financial stability that allows the whole system to function, including publishing riskier, less commercial books.
It keeps the lights on.
Basically, yes. And third, which I find really fascinating and maybe a bit sobering, is the idea of the ephemerality of fame.
Things don't last.
Especially bestseller fame. Sutherland talks about the concept of the dead bestseller. These are books that, in their day, sold absolutely colossal numbers. They were everywhere. Everyone was talking about them.
And now?
Now. Completely forgotten. Nobody reads them. Nobody talks about them. They're just gone from the cultural conversation.
Wow. Can you think of an example?
Oh, there are loads from, say, the 70s or 80s. Huge, huge books then. But you'd struggle to find them now outside of specialist secondhand shops. And that rapid obsolescence, Sutherland argues, proves something important.
Mm.
That bestseller status is primarily a measure of contemporary relevance. What society is obsessed with or needs to read about right now. It's not necessarily a measure of timeless literary merit or enduring quality.
Oof, that dead bestseller idea really makes you look at the current charts differently. Okay, let's try and crystallize this. What are the core statements or ideas Sutherland really hammers home?
I think core idea one has to be that definition. Bestsellers are defined by velocity, not just total volume. It's that initial speed, that buzz right at the start that turns a book into a true phenomenon.
Absolutely. And tied to that is core idea two, which is that financial risk model,
yeah.
The publisher as casino.
Right. Placing huge bets on a few potential jackpots, knowing those have to cover all the other losses across their entire list. It's a high wire act.
It really is. And then maybe the most challenging one, particularly for traditional literary types, is core idea three.
Which is?
If you really want to understand a society, don't just look at the books its highbrow critics are praising. Ask, what are its people actually reading in massive numbers? So the bestsellers, regardless of whether critics think they're good or not, are the clearest cultural barometers we have. They tell us what's really on people's minds.
Exactly. Which leads to some really practical applications, I think. How this analysis changes how we interact with books.
Okay, like what, how does this affect me, the reader?
Well, for the everyday reader, it suggests becoming a much more critical consumer. When you walk into that bookstore and see the huge displays at the front.
The ones piled high.
Yeah. Sutherland's analysis helps you see them not necessarily as the best books available or even the most interesting, but rather as the result of very specific, very calculated strategic investments. Mm-hmm. High advances. Big marketing pushes.
So it's not an accident they're there. It encourages you to maybe look beyond that front table, explore the mid-list, the backlist.
Precisely. It can be quite liberating, actually, to realize the hype is manufactured and you can choose based on your own interests, not just what's being pushed hardest.
Okay. What about for someone trying to write a book, an aspiring author?
Well, the lesson there is maybe a bit tougher, but really important. Sutherland makes it clear that success in modern publishing usually requires both things. Genuine craft, writing a good book.
Yes, obviously.
And a strong sense of cultural awareness. understanding the market. You need to write a great book, sure. But ideally, it also needs to be a book that can be effectively sold into a recognizable market category.
So the most brilliant, unique book in the world might struggle if nobody knows how to market it.
Sadly, yes. Or if it doesn't tap into something people are already thinking about. It's about finding that intersection of art and marketability. It's a tough reality.
And for people not in publishing at all, say business professionals.
Oh, there are huge lessons here. The principles Sutherland outlines for manufacturing literary hype, they're totally transferable.
How so?
Think about it. Leveraging trusted influencers like Oprah did. Using strategic timing like the hardback, paperback, staggered release. Creating urgency and buzz through that initial sales velocity.
Yeah, you see that with movie openings, tech product launches, fashion drops.
Exactly. The bestseller machine is just a highly refined ecosystem for product launches and marketing. The core principles apply across almost any industry, trying to create buzz and drive rapid adoption.
So it confirms that ultimately a product is a product, whether it's code or a novel. The marketing mechanics have similarities.
Pretty much, yeah. The packaging is different, but the underlying strategies can be very similar.
You know, diving into this, what really struck me, what surprised me most, was just how intentional it all is, the manufactured product idea.
Yeah.
We have this romantic image, don't we? The lonely genius writer pouring their soul onto the page for years.
Right, the tortured artist in the garret.
Exactly. But Sutherland pulls back the curtain and shows that the modern bestseller is often this meticulously engineered thing, a calculated risk designed very specifically to capture a particular slice of the market or a fleeting cultural mood. It's less magic, more mechanics.
It definitely forces you to look at popular culture through a more sophisticated lens. Maybe instead of just asking, is this book any good in some objective literary sense?
We should be asking.
What is it about this book right now that's making millions of people feel they need to read it? What collective anxiety is it soothing? What desire is it fulfilling? What does its massive success tell us about our own current moment?
Its popularity becomes the interesting data point, regardless of its perceived quality.
That's the big takeaway for me. Use bestsellers as a window.
Okay, that leaves us with a final thought then, a provocative one for you, the listener, maybe chew on. If bestseller status is often about contemporary relevance, and if fame is ephemeral, think about the biggest blockbusters right now, the ones dominating those airport shelves today.
Uh-huh.
Which one of those do you think will be a completely dead bestseller 50 years from now? Totally forgotten. And more importantly, what will the fact that that particular book was so huge today reveal about our current society when people look back?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think we can probably all nominate a few candidates in our heads right now.
Definitely something to think about. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.